Welcome to another episode of Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts, the show where we provide audio commentary to the Eisner-nominated comic book series Atomic Robo, written by Ryan Clevenger and drawn by Scott Wegner.
I'm Scott. Hi.
I'm Brian. This is my radio voice.
They must know our voices by now.
This episode, we are tackling the first volume of Atomic Robo. We started the series and we were doing the most recent volume, coming out issue by issue, Volume 7, The She-Devils of the Pacific. And now we are going back to the beginning.
Where it all started.
It's going to hurt.
Where the art was terrible and the writing was worse.
I understand, Scott, that you attempt to never look at this book.
I try not to, yes.
Here's how it goes with Scott and Atomic Robo. He never looks at anything before the volume he's working on right now. I think Volume 7 might be a slight... I think he can take that one.
I'm happy with Volume 7.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Volume 7 is the first volume that I'm pretty much all around okay with. There are definitely like mistakes I made and things I would like to do better, but overall... Yeah, I'm fine. And I guess they are all fine, but
they're all fine.
It's just painful to,
you know, Scott, it's not for us. It's for the kids, and the kids love it.
And the wacky kids, yeah. And most of my problems with the old stuff is like technical. Like I'm looking at the first page of the first issue right now, and
there's just perhaps the first time in 4 years.
Probably. Well, occasionally I accidentally see it when we open the cover of the trade paperbacks to, like, you know, sign the books, and yeah, I recoil in horror. You know, this first volume was, I had no idea what I was doing, so. It was hard.
Well, explain your background up to this point, Scott. You said you have no idea what you were doing, but I see here that very recently you've posted a comic you did back in the 90s.
That is really proof that you didn't know what you were doing. Compared to that, this first volume is a thesis.
You got Hank the Bounty Hunter by Scott and Jeff, 94.
Yeah, see, we didn't even put our last names on it. It was that good.
You know, yeah. Cher or Madonna, Scott, Jeff.
Right. And that is the Jeff who is now our current letterer and book designer. So I had done not a couple of comics. I did a couple pages of comics 20 years before drawing Atomic Robo number one. So I'm pretty sure I forgot everything that I may have accidentally learned while doing that, which was mostly nothing, because I did for that exactly what I did for Atomic Robo number one, which was scour the internet for pictures and comic books for panels that more or less lined up with what Brian was putting in the script and copied the poses and images because I had no concept of how to frame the objects within a panel, how to visually tell a story, any of that. Like, I'm looking at this first page, and there's just a million technical things wrong with it. But whatever, it gets the job done, I guess. Like, why are these the second and third panel? Why do I have the camera tilted in this dramatic Dutch angle when it's just a couple dudes standing around being bored on guard duty? Like, there's no reason to do that, which obviously most people are not going to notice at all. But to me, it drives me nuts.
Scott, you're laying your soul bare here. You're just admitting to being a complete incompetent. By your definition, anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was equal parts flattered and baffled when people liked my work. I still am a little bit, but really at this point, none of it met my own standards for what good art was. So like I would look at the comics I drew and I would just be like, oh, I wouldn't pay money for this.
What year was this, by the way?
Like, this was 2007. Well, okay. 2006, we did the book and then it came out 2007.
Yeah.
So somewhere in there. Last October was the 5th anniversary of Atomic Robo coming out.
My, how you've grown.
Yes. Mostly at the waistline.
Well, we're starting here. We've already kind of analyzed the first couple pages, but let's talk about the genesis of Robo. We touched on it in our previous episodes covering the She-Devils a little bit, but just to cover all our bases, here we are at the beginning. Let's do this right.
All right. Scott and I met one night at a gay bar.
Ah, yes. The bearded clam.
No,
that was it. That was
not the manhole. I had been thinking about Atomic Robo for quite a while, and in 2006 wanted to actually make a comic book out of it, so I went to the internet and scoured for artists, and Scott was the one who was stupid enough to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
Brian, at this point you were already somewhat famous as a webcomics author, so
I don't like to brag.
Did you have people, you know, like a laundry list of people being like, oh, Mr. Clevenger, I'll draw for you?
No, because I did this totally in secret.
Oh.
Because, you know, over the years of working on Ape at Theater, every now and then I would do, hey, you know, let's do a week of guest comics because I'm going to go on vacation for a week or whatever. And wow, the sludge that would come out of that every single time. We would eventually, like on the very final day, there'd be some really good contributions or whatever. Usually even more than I could actually use. But for this first 6 days, it was just whatever people just slapped together. And I didn't want to have to go through that with Atomic Robo.
Little did you know.
Yeah.
I think at that same point, even though I didn't think I could draw very well, I was still at the point where
I thought it was a terrible comic. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, so I thought it would match up perfectly with my artwork. And around the time you were looking to do something with the terrible idea of Robo, I was thinking that, well, while my art is terrible, it's no more terrible than a lot of comic book art I see. So I thought, what the hell? The only thing I'd ever been drawn back to again and again was illustrating comics. And it wasn't so much comics per se, but doing illustrations that told a story. So it could just be single images that somehow conveyed some sort of a narrative. I mean, like a great example of that now is like is Scott C's work on The Great Showdown and his various art books that my daughter absolutely loves, where it's weird, goofy, cute stuff. It's little images that convey lots and lots of stuff most of the time. So I wasn't having and I wasn't able to have the career I had planned on having in aviation because
it wasn't 1943 anymore.
Well, that's part of the problem. It wasn't the 40s anymore, which I had failed to research before going to college. And I also ended up meeting somebody and then we had a child and I had a lot of personal responsibilities that had not been in the game plan when I went to school because it was going to be go to school, then go to Alaska and try and get work up there as a bush pilot. And then I was really interested in flying for like the parks services, doing like firebombing. And the Peace Corps was a big, big draw to me. I wanted to go to Africa, use my flying skills there to, you know, deliver cargo and do humanitarian aid work and whatnot. And so I had choices. It was either settle for something I didn't want to be doing in aviation, which I ended up doing for a couple of years. And finally said, screw it. You know, the one thing I really enjoy, I enjoy it way more than flying is drawing, and decided to make a move on it, even though I thought it wasn't that good. It made sense at the time. I don't know how to explain it now.
We were young and stupid.
Right. That's a big
and now point. We're old, yeah, and stupid.
Now we're just old and stupid, but yeah.
We have no excuses anymore. It's embarrassing. I just emotionally abused him into continuing to draw.
Pretty much. And we had no idea what we were doing.
No.
And maybe we slightly know what we're doing now, just a little bit, but not much. I'm just kind of flipping through the first couple pages as Robo crashes into Helsingard's base here in issue one. I can see what I was trying to do in a lot of this stuff, and I can see how I would do it differently now. But wow, I guess it's cool. It's neat to see someone not knowing what they're doing, but at least I can see in it where I was trying to go with it. That's neat.
You know, I've seen a lot of art by people who don't know what they're doing, and you fake it very well.
Thanks. All these heavy blacks. Those are the only comics I had left when Brian contacted me, because I hadn't read comics regularly in 10 years or so. The only books I've kept were my old Hellboy graphic novels. And so the only reference I had was Mignola's work, but his stuff is the page is 90% black and really subtle and geometric and cool. But I was trying to translate that into my cartoony stuff because I was trying to learn from what I was seeing on his pages. And a lot of it just doesn't work so well when you're not using huge black areas. It screws things up. I was also learning to ink along the way, too. I had never inked anything except for the last four pages of Hank the Bounty Hunter. I'd never inked anything prior to this.
What about the genesis of the story and the character?
I think that robots are cool.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. No, in the very beginning, Atomic Robo was an attempt to cash in on the then growing interest in like anime and manga and all that jazz. So it was a much more stupid concept. It was more like it was much more akin to something along the lines of Dexter's Lab. But that didn't really interest me personally. It was just like, hey, easy cash in. And luckily, mm-hmm. I just had on the idea long enough that it had already become passé, and so I never did cash in on it. But I still had this cool idea for, you know, just this robot adventurer character. And over the years, I just really embraced my lifelong love of science and sci-fi and history and alternate history and weird real history, and just decided to smash those two ideas together to solve the structural problems of most of mainstream comics, i.e. Huge, incomprehensible, ever-shifting continuity. And I figured, hey, you can solve all of that if you just have this robot character whom everyone already knows is super tough and ageless and just has a bunch of adventures across the 20th century.
Bam.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned, you know, the original impetus behind it was to cash in. And
yeah, and then we did the exact opposite.
Yeah, seriously. Well, I don't mean cash in and, well, I guess I do mean it in the normal way you'd interpret it. But your thought was not to be super cynical, but your thought was, you know, I need to make a living at this. What sells? And it was a very marketing, it was a very business-driven approach to making comics. And I had the same thoughts myself, which is funny because, you know, you read our promise about, you know, no cheesecake, no, basically no stupid stuff. But that's what's, as far as we've seen in the comic market, that's what sells is stupid stuff like that.
But sorry to interrupt, but I would like to say that I think that the reason that stuff sells is because it's so prominently produced that it has chased away absolutely everyone else.
Yeah, it's kind of forced on the industry.
I don't disagree with that. Yeah, I do not disagree with that. When I sat down to do this, part of it, I'm like looking at my wife and I'm looking at my then toddler
four
daughter. I think so. Yeah. I don't know. She's
whatever. I don't know. Well, that one is.
She's that other short person.
He's getting taller. I don't know.
Yeah, geez. I think she's almost as tall as her mom now. And I'm like, well, I want to make work that they would possibly, not specifically that they would want to read that's relevant to their interests, but the work that I could put in front of this little girl and not be embarrassed by and not have to explain things away. I remember there was this great moment on one of those like VH1 I Love the 80s thing, and it was some Hispanic guy from Miami who had like a super like popular Macarena style song, and it was just all about like jiggling butts and having sex with ladies. And this guy comes back later in life in his late 40s, and he's like, yeah, it's like, and then I have to explain that to my little kids, and they're both girls, and it's like awkward. Like, I didn't want to have that experience. And just, you know, the comics that had always struck me as being the best comics, if I couldn't specifically say why, were books like Hellboy and Bone and like Akira, things like that, where that weird surface level titillation factor was not there. But yet the first comic I sat down and designed as something that I could sell to a publisher and go anywhere with was exactly that. It was this woman who was basically kind of like a spy cat thief kind of thing who had quasi weird mystical and or mutant powers. I don't even remember. But basically she was just like, you know, skin tight outfit, giant breasts, lots of ass shots. And it was pure eye candy with very, very little substance. When I took a look at it, I was really disgusted with it. And redesigned it into something that met the criteria that would eventually become stuff like Our Promise and just how we generally go about making comics. And it completely transformed the character and my interest in it. And I've still never done anything with it because of time, but a lot of the ideas have ended up getting popped into Robo one way or another instead. But I remember talking about this at Kineticon, and there was this father in the audience who, this really sweet guy, comes and sees us every year, although he didn't stop at our table at New York Comic Con this year. I saw him a couple times and we were swamped each time, but he's got a daughter who's about my daughter's age who loves Robo, and she's a huge fan of like The Sparrow and whatnot. And every year I do a little sketch for her and whatnot. And I could see, like, I think I shattered him a little bit with that admission that I was also just as, you know, cynical and superficial as everyone else is. I haven't talked to him since then. Like, he has not come to our table since I said that. And I remember almost kind of making eye contact with him at the convention when I was talking about this, and he just looked so sad. I mean, he might have eaten something from the concession stand that wasn't agreeing with him, but I don't know.
Why should he be sad, though, that you figured out that that was wrong and don't do it?
I don't know. I'm probably misinterpreting the whole thing. I just, Dave, I need to talk to you, buddy. Come to us at Kineticon next year. For some reason, I have this weird guilt, like I haven't talked to you in a while. And I don't know. Anyway, we both said we're going to make comics, and here's all the things we hate about comics. Let's go make comics that we hate. And we kind of ran with that for a little while.
Yeah, for like a month. And it was like, oh.
Yeah. And then I couldn't live with myself anymore. Yeah. But then when you and I met up, it was kind of interesting in that I had sat down and made basically a list of what I liked and what I didn't like and the kind of comics I wanted to make and the kind of comics I did not want to work on. We were just coming from the same place and with the same ideas and just kind of ran headlong into each other at the perfect time. Mm-hmm.
So then this first Robo story, Brian, how much did you know about Robo at the time as a character?
Funny couple of stories here for various degrees of funny. The first issue is actually the last one that was written for this volume.
Wow.
Because we had five issues. And so the first one was number two. And then Scott and I were like, well, we kind of feel like we want this. We need some kind of introductory, not an origin exactly, but something like an origin. I forget why exactly. I think we just felt like that would be the best way to introduce publishers and the audience to Robo.
Let's see. So volume two is the ants, three is the pyramid, and four and five are the Helsingard story, and they're all basically set in the modern day, although they do reference back to older things.
Yeah.
And you do have the flashbacks, kind of, but there wasn't a specific, you know, we kept referencing like Indiana Jones and things like that, and there was nothing that really specifically addressed that time period or that feeling. And so, yeah, I think we just needed something that was
earlier.
Yeah.
But yeah, how much did I know? Well, I had spent about 10 years prior to that point thinking about Atomic Robo off and on. Clearly, I was thinking about other things as well, because I'm not quite that slow. But I had figured out sort of the broad strokes of his history, that he was invented in 1923 by Tesla. There was controversy over his status as, you know, what kind of being is this? Is this property? Is this thing intelligent? If it's intelligent, do we give it human rights, etc.? And just plotting out different, you know, story beats throughout the decades. You know, he has an encounter with this or an encounter with that, or he crosses paths with some big historical event or whatever. So we had a fairly strong skeleton going in. And in fact, there's stuff referenced in Volume 1 that we have not yet come back to. We've been planting seeds all along.
Sinister gardeners of plots.
Yes.
I had to figure out Robo from scratch. I guess in a way, I hope that having someone from the outside, having to intimately learn this character, kind of like maybe provided a fresh view. Because there was some stuff with Robo I felt had to be changed.
Yeah, and absolutely for the better.
Such as?
Rockets in his feet like Astro Boy so he could fly. pop-up arm blasters that would get more and more sci-fi as the decades went by, which I wasn't opposed to, but I think I thought it was more interesting visually to just have Robo holding stuff instead of having things pop out of him. There's like the final Robo design. It's more or less Robo as everyone knows him. And I crossed Robo with this other character of mine, whose name I can't even remember now, but I was also kind of working on like a World War II Indiana Jones spy sort of thing. This guy was like an operative for the OSS and had adventures in Europe and whatnot. And I had this sketch I'd done of him just in grungy fatigues and just looking all beat up and gross. And I kind of merged them with this very kind of clean, sometimes dressed robot I was trying to design for Brian. And I think just the clean lines of Robo with the grungy, the Wegner crud, as Brian calls it, all over the pants, and the crappy old sick shooter instead of a fancy sci-fi blaster, just kind of it was very much like a, you know, your chocolates in my peanut butter, sir, kind of a moment for us.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's also the point where we're really stripping away all this extraneous stuff that Robo could do, until basically he was just, if it wasn't for his PhDs, he would just be, you know, this very kind of normal every man kind of
janitor bot.
Yeah, it's actually quite stupid.
So with this first issue, which was actually the sixth issue,
yes.
Now that I know this, it's kind of a weird way for me to approach this, because I can't think of it as, well, this was really it's the first thing anybody's going to read, but for you guys, it's creative process. It was the sixth thing anybody was going to read.
You know, but also it's also the first story that we both worked on.
Yeah.
Because Brian had already written what became issue 2 through 6. So up to that point, I was just looking at scripts and trying to interpret them. And I hadn't drawn any of them, I was just reading them. But this was the first one we drew. So in addition to this being Robo's sort of origin story, this really is the first Robo story that we collaborated on together in any way.
In that case, telling the story, you said you set out to have sort of an origin thing. We got here in the second page, the stakes are high because a general in the U.S. military is offering Robo legal status as a human being and American citizenship, which is pretty big. Like, it's not always in a Robo story, no matter what time it's in, that you'll actually encounter something that is a pivotal moment in Robo's life, because it's got that whole Buckaroo Banzai. The story's already been ongoing so much. He'll mention something important as an offhand thing, and the stuff you'll see on page is obviously very exciting, but it won't be turning points in his life necessarily.
I didn't even think of this first issue until it was Scott's idea, like, hey, we should go earlier, you know, sort of an origin. And what's funny is that this first issue is actually probably the most pivotal, well, certainly the first volume and perhaps the whole series. I mean, because A, this is where Robo finally, after like 17 years of, you know, trying to do it legitimately through the legal system, does the thing that gets him his U.S. citizenship and gets him, you know, granted full human rights. This is the first time he encounters Helsingard, who becomes this weird quasi-threat throughout the rest of the 20th century.
Which, again, we'll have to get back to.
We have plans. So it sets into motion other things, because it puts Robo in a certain place in the world and in history, and gets him some attention and creates the impetus for the need for there to eventually be a Majestic 12 and weird Tesla tech spreading throughout the world. I've always thought that was interesting that this sort of, we almost did it issue. As like an afterthought, and yet it's like so important to the overall mythos.
Yeah. Looking specifically at page two here, man, I can vaguely recall sweating over this entire page because it's like, oh, New York City, draw that.
What?
And what? This is like page two of the first real comic I've ever drawn. I have to draw all of New York City at once. Oh, crap. I think every panel on here was painful. To give you an idea of how much I didn't know. So, okay. So there's a drawing of New York City that kind of worked out okay. It's good enough. There's a bunch of boxes. They look like skyscrapers. We all get the idea. Although for some reason, the Empire State Building is right down in the Battery. But whatever, it worked. Then the second panel, the second panel with the general sitting at his desk there. See, it's pretty benign, right? Guy sits at desk, does these things. Well, okay, I sketched in studios with live models and things like that, but I've never just from my memory drawn a person sitting. I mean, it seems like, right, this should be easy, right? Never done that before. So here's this dude just sitting at his desk. That was an amazing challenge. And a phone. There's a phone on the desk. I've never drawn a telephone. Oh, crap. What does a telephone look like? It was ridiculous. I must have searched for hours for reference for the stupid little photos on the back wall behind him. And, you know, they're obscured by word balloons and they're cut off. And this, everything on here was just like an utter nightmare for me because I thought I was like, yeah, I'm going to just jump in. This is going to be great. And every panel, it was just like, oh, my gosh, I have no idea what I'm doing. Amazing anxiety over everything. And like the plane on page three there, that was almost the very first airplane I've ever drawn in my life.
My favorite thing about all this, though, is knowing that Scott goes through it again every single time for every page.
Pretty much. Well, I can draw phones now. I've also learned to ignore at my peril occasionally, like in volume six, where Brian asked for a phone. And I'm like, ha, 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 smartphones are easy. For completely forgetting that, like, you know, 22 pages earlier, we'd made a joke about how Robo can't use iPads and smartphones, whatever.
Let's talk about this issue here. You, like you were saying, it features Helsingard really heavily, and this is his origin story, essentially, and he's one of Robo's greatest villains, perhaps the greatest villain, in that he is a constant problem throughout time. And his origin is, by Robo standards, relatively unconventional. It's the most fast and loose that you play with science in the whole thing. And here it is right off the cuff and with him with this the Vril organ and becoming this kind of energy being. And that's a lot tougher to swallow than most things you guys go for. I mean, in the second issue, Robo criticizes, you know, the existence of giant ants. And there's a sea monster, too, you know, and other situations. But, you know, a human transforming into an energy being and then being implanted into a robot, that's a bigger deal. Do you feel in retrospect that Helsingard is a product of a more naive time for where you were headed with Robo? Or is he simply the reason he's such a threat is because he's the one thing that defies everything you've set up?
Kind of a little bit of both. I definitely, for a long time, fretted over the whole Hollow Earth inclusion. His reference to a civilization that he has apparently destroyed down there. The reaction of the Vril organ, everything about it, you know, the energy, everything you were saying. Because we never come back to that. There was no plan to. Well, I'm getting to that. For years, let me restate it. For years, there was no plan to come back to it, to refer to Hollow Earth, because it's just too weird. It's just too stupid. I love it as like a conspiracy theory. I love it, sci-fi stories about it. Other than the fact that the 19th century ones tend to be incredibly racist. But then that's 19th century sci-fi for you. But anyway.
That's 19th century, period.
Yeah. So over the years, you know, thinking about Robo, filling up his world, why not have a Hollow Earth? Not the way that it's always or traditionally identified as literally the whole Earth is just this hollow sphere. That's idiotic. We have satellites and all kinds of, you know, plate tectonics. We know what's going on down there now. You know, Hollow Earth was this quote unquote theory that was proposed back when we had no idea what was going on under the ground. We knew that caves existed, so it was easy to think, well, what if there was a huge cave and the whole Earth was a cave? Oh! But we figured out how we could do little pockets of Hollow Earth and or just weird elements under the Earth, and we could explain how nobody really knew about it or had never really interacted with it as a result of its isolation, and we could use those little pockets to just go crazy because all the rules are off, and who better to involve in that than Dr. Dinosaur, the real character where all the rules are thrown out the window and nothing makes sense anymore. The fact that Helsingard dabbles in that stuff, you know, it leads to his doom. So now we don't really have to worry about Helsingard and Hollow Earth. But it did open up some interesting ideas for me to fill up Robo's history, pre-Robo's history. So now we were doing a new series of Real Science Adventures. That's six issues of Tesla and his group. And now I'm percolating with more ideas of what they were doing even before that. I have thought it was a mistake for years, but we figured out how to make it work.
Well, I actually wasn't even thinking about Volume 8. I was actually thinking of Edison and all of his weird stuff. And that there's a certain fun with these old, either real or fictional scientific characters who have kind of transitioned from the 19th century into the 20th century. You know, there was that bit of mysticism that went along with some of the science.
Yeah.
Because things were still some things were not understood yet. And that's where I was actually thinking of, because the idea of like the Vril energy and whatnot ties very much into what Edison was doing also with the Odic energy and all that.
Yeah, it's a very similar, and it's
all in the ether.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you conflate those two, because at the time, especially the 19th century and early 20th century, where Edison would have picked up on the Odic force, there were a lot of these competing semi-mystical, semi-pseudoscientific theories about life and the universe and everything. Hollow Earth was definitely one. Vril came out of that. And then you got the Orgone and Odic and all kinds of stuff going on. And so it is fun to have these established ideas in reality and then just, you know, add laser beams to them and throw a robot in there and just have a lot of fun with it. We should just credit Wikipedia as co-writer and get it over.
Man, you know what? Wikipedia gets a bad rap. I'm sorry.
I love Wikipedia because all I need is a superficial beep-beep understanding. And that is exactly what Wikipedia gives me.
Use your imagination. Go from there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm continuing to just flip through pages here. All these heavy blacks. What were they thinking? The works from Mike McNaughton.
You know, even as early as the second issue, you move away from that.
Because I was so horrified by by what happened in the first issue.
What have I done?
I got a question. How many countries is Robo translated in?
He's Italian.
There's Spanish. There's Portuguese, I think.
Is there?
I definitely see reviews on sites that are specifically Portuguese and not Spanish.
Maybe
English. There's French. Was there French? There was talk of French.
No. Comics are art in France. They would never translate our stuff.
That's true.
What made me think of it was all the swastikas and German military stuff. I know that, you know, if it was translated, you'd have to change everything if it was translated to German.
It's interesting too, because I remember when we went to Italy, we were invited over by Renoir Press, who does the translation over there, and we did this amazing convention, had a fabulous week.
It was amazing.
Brian ate horse.
I know he did eat horse. I tasted it. It was delicious.
It was amazing.
And I met two people at the convention who loved Robo and were excited to get it. And they'd already picked it up in English somehow. And they were actually not cool with us translating it into Italian, because they're like, well, everyone here speaks English and reads it more or less. And their opinion was that the different languages just serve to separate us somehow. And it would be better if we all just kind of came together in a common language. And it was an interesting thought that I'd never applied to comic books at all. But
would assume that, Americans are just egotistical for thinking everybody should speak English. But there's somebody saying the opposite.
Legally, English is the international language of business and law. At least in aviation, that was always the case. Like, everything is in English. It was the most common language in all the countries that were involved at the time. So it ended up becoming the default. And then there was that awesome attempt to make Esperanto a real thing, which I still think should happen. But
that's one of my favorite little artifacts in Red Dwarf, is there's a lot of Esperanto in the background, because in the distant future, Esperanto was accepted.
Brought there from 1996 by Ricardo Montalban. Oh man, I'm just looking at Robo's wrists in this issue. I had not figured out how to make wrists happen for Robo yet. It just looks so weird.
That was an ongoing process.
Oh, God, yeah. And his hands, they're like metal sausages pinned to a plate. Like, I don't know what the hell is going on.
I love you and your food art.
I like food art. Oh, his head is no longer a marshmallow for me. I have moved on. I finally figured out thinking of Robo in three-dimensional terms because he's got a bit of a beak. He's actually got a turtle head.
Oh, yeah, I see.
A turtle skull is what I kind of work with more in my head now when I'm drawing his head.
Sure.
In this first issue, it's been like a bucket slapped on a giant spring. Like, it's just so weird. The little fiddly rings in his neck. And
I like
that. Because originally, you wanted all sorts of cables and stuff in his neck, as I recall, like functioning like tendons and muscles would.
Yeah.
And in my head, I was just thinking, there's no goddamn way. I can't draw that over and over again. So this was the compromise.
And, you know, for your love of explosions, that was a good thing, because otherwise, how could you validate him surviving all those explosions all the time?
That is true. That is true. So this was the compromise, this kind of vacuum hose thing. Oh, he's so goofy looking. His little tiny shoulders and elbows.
Who drew this?
This is terrible.
This fan art is awful. Yeah, you don't know the artist of this, Scott.
No.
You didn't start until volume 6.
Yes, that's what we'll tell everyone. Oh, God, and this last page, I think, is taken panel for panel out of an issue of Invincible. Sorry, Ryan, but it was a really awesome thing where something happened and Invincible lands miles and miles away from whatever it was that punched him or blew up or whatever. So it's like panel 1, Mike Mignola explosion. Panel 2, Scott draws a crummy volcano. Panel 3, 4, and 5, I'll basically just steal these from Ryan Otley and put them in here because it works so well in his comic.
Plagiarism is a great learning tool.
Oh, hey, Matt, have you seen there was a Hellboy Universe book that came out recently, not about Hellboy, but about a character from the universe. There was a Lobster Johnson miniseries a couple years ago,
yeah,
and it involved this dude who was like a test pilot of a Vril-powered Iron Man suit, basically. And I guess he got his own miniseries. And there is a sequence that is basically, in almost panel for panel, the sequence of Robo blasting into Helsingard's here and popping out of the... it's drawn way better than this is.
Yeah, and, well, let's put that out there first.
Yeah, oh yeah. I forget who was it. Jason Latour. And it's gorgeous. And it's not panel for panel. I imagine it's like he probably saw this at some point and it stuck in his head.
Yeah.
But it was just, I was looking at it and like people, I got a million links to it. Like, oh, they're stealing your idea. I don't think so. But even if that was, like, I can't think of anything more flattering that, you know, someone doing that and recycling a visual idea like that. Like, why the hell not?
Scott, if you have a heart attack, I'm approaching Jason about taking over art duties.
That's fine. I'm okay with that. I am okay with that. I think as our first effort together, it was okay.
Right. 2 out of 10 would not buy.
Avoid at all costs. There's a reason it's free on Comixology.
you know what offends me, though? All right, so volume 1 got nominated for an Eisner.
Yeah, it's our worst volume.
Yeah.
It's our absolute worst volume.
And, like, it took them until volume 6 to redo it? Like, really?
Yeah. I can never figure out where I come down on that, because when they told us we were nominated for an Eisner, I had to go to Google.
Don't say this.
To see what an Eisner was.
No. What happened was, so the news breaks, and then Scott IMs me. First, it was, what's an Eisner? And I said, well, it's the industry standard award, like the Oscars, named after Will Eisner. Who's Will Eisner?
Maybe.
Scott is the least comics literate person working in comics.
That is why Scott has to look so much stuff up.
I hated comics. How do I put this? I found American comics. We're not recording, are we?
We are recording.
We can record. We could record. That's fine. You know what? As a kid, I found American comics in the main to be terrible. And compared to their European and Asian counterparts, they are terrible.
Now, let's be specific here. This was the 90s, and there was just no way around it.
Yeah, this was the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And back when the access to non-American stuff was extremely limited, so you really only got the best of the best. I grant you that, obviously. But the art styles of most comics that I was seeing, which is primarily mainstream stuff, was so stiff and so wooden and so boring. And I was really inspired by animation and film. And when I was a kid, I was going to go to art school for animation because I liked the movement in it and the life that was in it. And all of that was completely absent in most American comics that I ever saw. So I had zero interest in them. And I had a brief interest during the 90s, as you could tell from that first page of Hank the Bounty Hunter. I discovered X-Men, I think, right around when Jim Lee started with issue number one. My brother had bought a copy of it, and I read it, and I was like, well, this is pretty good. I don't understand why I can see their muscles through their clothes. Looks a little strange to me, but it's a number one. There was some good action, and all right, I'll read a couple. And I got hooked for a while on the concept of the X-Men. And when everyone left to form Image, I stopped reading the X-Men because I didn't like the people that took over. And I started going backwards in time, back to about like the Fall of the Mutants, I guess, stuff. Like Mark Silvestri, his run on things, he had a very kind of interesting, it was like more like an old school newspaper comic strip style to his art. Like it reminded me of when you read Spider-Man or the Phantom in black and white newspapers. I really dug his stuff. Plus, you know, Longshot and Dazzler. Whoa.
Right.
That was dope. Anyway, he had a lot of life in his artwork, which is what I enjoyed about it. It was very dynamic. And like later on down the road, it got kind of extreme to like everything in the 90s. And I didn't care for it too much. But his older stuff like that, I thought was really interesting. And then I kind of, you know, I noodled around in the superhero world looking for good stuff. And I think the only thing else I ever found that I liked was Alan Davis and his run, the whole Excalibur thing. And there were oddball things. Like, I loved Arthur Adams' work, and like, he did that giant size X-Men with the X-Babies in Mojo World. And I didn't understand any of the X-Men story at that point. I didn't understand how the continuity changed constantly and any of that. So to me, this was like this weird, isolated, standalone story where I had a vague idea who the characters were, and suddenly they were little kids, and they were drawn really, really well and cartoony and interestingly, and I enjoyed it. But for the most part, yeah, I had no idea about mainstream comics. And
you weren't, I assume you were probably, if you're saying American comics, so you probably weren't reading any of the independents that were out at the time, like Cerebus the Aardvark or anything like that.
Oh, no, those I was. I was. So Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number one was the first comic or one of the first comics that I bought on my own. The Marvel used to do these oversized magazine copies of versions of the Star Wars when they had the license for that.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother bought me some of those because I was a Star Wars fan, and mostly they were terrible, but I hated them just because they were Star Wars. But Ninja Turtles, Cerebus, I never quite got into. Adolescent Radioactive Ninja Hamsters, that was a big one. That was when I discovered parody and humor comics, and holy crap was I hooked. There was another great one called Gun Fury, which was like, imagine psychotic Frank Castle the Punisher as portrayed by Adam West. It was so nuts and just so crazy that I adore it. Always stuck with me. I found it on the internet last year, and I bought all like 6 or 7 issues of it just to have them. And I'm looking at them now, and they're, you know, they're not that great, but like as a kid, it was like amazing humor to me, and it was just like the best thing ever. And then I was buying Robotech comic books because I liked the Robotech anime, and oh my god, they made a comic book version, yay! But other than that, yeah, I wasn't really reading stuff. And eventually, I found Hellboy and Bone and independent like creator-owned work like that.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really interested me. But they're so divorced from what you think of when you think of walking into most comic book shops. Right. You know, that's just a tiny portion of what's there. So, yeah, I had zero interest in this stuff. So the medium itself fascinated me. And I ended up discovering, you know, like Akira and Appleseed and these things that are like, you know, really like these books that set the tone and the look of manga for decades that, you know, these were amazing works. And again, all by a single creator. And so the comic book thing of having constantly rotating artists and writers and everyone reworking things, and it really turns me off. It was fun to be into the X-Men for a little while, and I even interned at Marvel Comics in high school, and that was an excellent experience, but I had none of the personal attachment to those properties that a lot of people did and do. So, yeah, I didn't know who Will Eisner was because, well, American comics, whatever. Right. So while I was really, really disappointed when we didn't get it, because I was like, wow, this is like a real Cinderella story thing. If we had, I didn't know what it was 5 minutes before we didn't get it. So it didn't really matter. It was cool that we got nominated again recently, but I get more out of it when like libraries put us on their lists of, you know, top 10 recommendations for young readers and things like that. I guess that's the audience I would like to put my focus on, is people who are looking for something that's interesting and different and unique from other stuff that's out there. Also that we also tap into something that appeals to more mainstream comic readers. I think it's great, but I've never come at this hoping to get that audience, I guess.
Right.
How do we get the Spider-Mans? How do we get the Supermans?
I was always more into like history and hard science fiction stuff. So the idea of skin tight suits and shooting laser beams from your eyes was just, it was stupid to me. I was always more interested in stories about guys like Indiana Jones, who were extraordinary, but they were just dudes. And most of the time they were getting their asses kicked and they overcame their obstacles despite their limitations. And I always found that far more compelling than, oh, here's Superman. He's basically flying Jesus and you can't touch him unless you come up with all these convoluted rules and mechanisms to defeat him.
Let's cut to some reader / listener questions right now. If you guys ever want to ask Brian and Scott some questions, you know, figure out what volume we're about to be recording. We'll usually have some notes posted on the Nerdy Show forums. You can also ask us on Twitter, # AskRobo, and then we'll find your questions. We got one from Darren Reed on Twitter. He says, have you ever considered doing a motion/audio version of Robo for visually impaired readers?
I think we've been asked that before, haven't we? You know, it's not something that we've actively considered. It's certainly not something we would be opposed to. I don't know how we would do that, though. But if there was already someone who was doing this kind of work and they wanted to adapt Robo for it, I would think that would be great.
Yeah, presumably you'd need the backing of your publisher and or a third party.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure Red 5, our publisher, would endorse it.
More people.
Oh, no, more people reading our stuff is terrible. But yeah, I think it's something that we are not equipped to do on our own. We've been promising a merchandise store for freaking T-shirts and stickers for 2 years now. And we can't even pull that off. We're just waiting on something. It's finally actually in the works. But, you know, this sounds like a much more complicated project. So we would definitely need to have.
We would need adults.
Yes, that's what I was just thinking. Yeah.
Well, I guess then this would be a good time to ask what the status of Atomic Robo Last Stop, the animated short film, is. Do you guys know?
Yeah.
Very nearly done.
Oh.
Yeah. It is trucking right along.
There was a time where there was an additional Robo short that was being discussed. What's happened with that?
There have been a couple of other Robo shorts, but they've all
disappeared.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's all Victory's game at this point, and they are trucking right along. And yeah, we're excited to see that come out. And we're waiting on that to come out and see the reaction to that before we announce the next thing we want to do. Because that'll be interesting. Because that was very cool, and we're really excited to see it come into fruition. But in a weird way, it's like this is like very much Victory's project, and it's just using our stuff. We're kind of involved, but they're doing all the heavy lifting on it and all the footwork, and they did all the Kickstarter stuff. And you know, we're just like the quasi celebrity who comes out and endorses the shampoo, you know, on some old 50s live television show.
We got a couple questions from Berto Elcon on the Nerdy Show forums. He asks, why the scattered timeline? Why not go in order with Robo stories?
Boring.
Nobody really wants to sit down to Robo's life story in order, starting in 1923 and working our way slowly but inexorably forwards. Additionally, even if there are people out there who want that, what if we think of something new to add into the past? Oh, too late. We did that. We skipped the 30s already. We're in the 40s now. We can't go back and do the story. The whole idea is to do it in these jumping around so that every volume is a new accessible jumping on point. And it leaves us these gaps in the timeline so that at any point, if we think of something really cool to put further back, we can just go and do that. And moving forward, assuming even if that never happens, we're always working on the next idea that has us really excited. So we never have to sit here and, oh, we got to slog through all of World War II. Oh, this is going to take forever before we can get on to, you know, the Jet Age.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's really the appeal lies in that ability to tell whatever story we want to tell in whatever era we want to tell, when we want to tell it. I mean, I already find it maddening to know what we're going to be drawing and working on for the next 3 or 4 years and not being able to get to it.
Yeah.
And that's jumping all through time and having fun with stuff. Like, I could not imagine.
A slavish devotion to linearity is what has really hobbled, Marvel and DC. They're always taking place now, always now, 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 now. So you get effectively what this guy's asking for. And look at what it's done to their stories. You can hold together continuity these days for almost a whole year before you have to reboot or ignore, you know, half the chunk of it or whatever.
Yeah, I remember someone once floating the idea that, you know, it would be cool to approach superhero comics where anytime a new creative team took over, they had longer runs, but when someone else took over, it basically reset everything so you could retell or tell different stories, but they weren't reliant on each other. Kind of in the way that, like, Arthur C. Clarke would write his books, like 2001, 2010, they take place in parallel universes or they're somewhere in the multiverse because the technology that he tried to use real technology and then technology would change and he would integrate that into the next project. And yes, it was referencing the same characters and same events, but they were from slightly different universes to account for.
Especially between those first two books, considering one is set in the moons of Saturn and one's set in the moons of Jupiter.
Yeah.
We jump around because it's fun to jump around.
Jump up and get down. So,
hell yeah.
So there you have it.
Bottles and cans, just clap your hands.
Berto has another question, which is, have you had any problems keeping the Atomic Robo promise so far?
But does he know I have two turntables and a microphone? I think the only part of the promise we've had trouble with is the no late books, which I think we've had to modify now it's like no delays that we can avoid kind of a thing. Yeah. We have had books drop late and it drives me nuts.
You do actually cite Diamond specifically. No delays that we have any control over, i.e. Diamond will be Diamond.
Well, yeah, there's like weird scheduling things, or our printer is, you know, we thought they were taking the books this week, but then they have another job they're still working on. They can't take it until this next week.
And my favorite, we ran out of paper.
We ran out of paper. Yeah, that was a radiator pump. Amazing one.
Oh, that was a good bleep.
Put a big old pump handle on that.
I mean, it's not like we're using ho-dunk, nobody's ever heard of them printers. We're using the printer everyone uses for comics. What do you mean you ran out of paper? You know that you're... Oh, whatever.
So we'll link to the Atomic Robo promise on this episode's page.
Yeah, as far as the other stuff, the no cheesecake, the no...
That is actually super easy.
Yeah, it's the rest of it's really, really easy. I mean, I can't help it if I get pneumonia and can't work for a couple weeks. But
no eggs, no cheesecake, no reboots, no filler.
Yeah.
No problem.
Exactly. And again, that jumping around in time in Robo's life actually makes avoiding the no filler thing ridiculously. It's a non-issue. And again, because we're our own book, you don't have to worry about filler. So if I'm doing like X-Men, say, and there's a big summer event coming up, or we're coordinating something with the Avengers books, when you want things to line up properly, you get these issues where like nothing happens because you're stalling for time, basically.
Or you're needlessly over-explaining how things got to a certain point when you could just start the issue at the point.
Oh my God, yeah. I remember when we were in Austin, I bought that Avengers trade paperback because I wanted to read some Avengers, because what the hell, why not? I didn't know where to start with anything. Someone suggested the one I ended up getting, and it was 120 pages of Iron Man and Miss Marvel standing around. They had to rebuild the Avengers team, and like, you know, it was like fanboys and fangirls standing around saying, well, if I built my dream team, it would be this, except it was happening in the comic. And I'm not sure, like, is that reverse meta? Is that, I don't know what that is. It was just like, there was no story at all. It was 120 pages of zero story, of just like complete and utter pointless filler. It was beautiful. I forget who did the art, but it was beautifully drawn. And it was like, I instantly forgettable. So the promise, pretty easy to keep mostly.
We got one more question. It's from Ben Kidd via Twitter. What's the beef between Robo and Stephen Hawking?
You know, I think I figured this out.
When you only have one super robot in Robo's world?
I want to be one too. But, you know, in Volume 1, we introduced the rivalry between Atomic Robo and Stephen Hawking. And it's just this throwaway gag, and we never come back to it. But we never just do that. There's always a reason behind everything, even if you never see it on the page. And I've stalled since then, because I was just like, what was it for these two? Was it some kind of lover's quarrel and Hawking ended up with a girl? But then I thought, well, maybe that'll be perceived as cruel, because then people might think the joke is that Stephen Hawking could ever get a lady. But he's actually quite the playa, especially before, even after, but also before his condition, which is when this story would have taken place. But then you have to kind of super explain that and whatever. But I finally came down to it. Hawking was very strongly involved in our current understanding and current theories of black holes. I think that was their source of contention. Robo would have introduced the theory that black holes were related to the shadow from beyond time and the fifth cardinal direction, Zorth. So it was
yes, you would have.
Yeah. So it's this professional rivalry, and much like how Tesla and AC kind of won over Edison's direct current, Hawking's theory has proven to be more prevalent and useful or accurate or whatever. There was some really intense, you know, astrophysics theoretician bickering going on behind the scenes. And now they have this just borderline murderous rivalry with one another. Because if you consider what Hawking did, I mean, that's torture. That is 2 years of isolated. I mean, it's insane. It's maniacal.
I like that. That's good. That's good. And just as an aside, I recently watched the Star Trek Next Generation episode where Data is on the holodeck. I think he's analyzing his dreams or something like that with Einstein, Newton, and actual Stephen Hawking. and it was just amazing. They're playing poker too on the holodeck. It's beautiful stuff.
All right, guys. So if you want more Atomic Robo nuts and bolts, here's where to find it. Nerdyshow.com/Atomic Robo. We will be covering all of Robo all in good time. And when new Robo issues start coming out, well, we'll be going right back to the brand new stuff, giving you issue by issue coverage as they come out. If this is your first episode, welcome. If you haven't caught up on Robo, just follow some links at the Atomic Robo page and you will find yourself amidst some of the greatest action science of your life. And if you have caught up to Robo, but you haven't heard Nuts and Bolts before, then by all means, check out our issue by issue coverage of Atomic Robo Volume 7. And you will hear behind the scenes stuff you would never even think to ask questions about. Pretty extensive things, especially what with all the airplanes in it. Man, Scott goes crazy. It's fantastic. You want your healthy dose of strange military secrets and all that turned into science fiction? You'll be pleased. Scott, Brian, what do you guys got cooking in early 2013?
Oh, Lord, too much. We got the next batch of Real Science Adventures is coming out. And that is going to be 6 issues of Tesla's team beating the hell out of some big conspiracy to overthrow the United States government in the year 1893.
Awesome.
Don't question it.
Won't.
What else is there? Good. Volume 8. Scott's drawing that. First issue should be out in May.
Awesome. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Or metal sausages crossed.
Clank.
Clank.
That is Atomic Robo and the Savage Sword of Dr. Dinosaur, wherein people finally get what they've been asking us for, a series of Dr. Dinosaur going crazy and trying to take over or destroy the Earth.
So if it doesn't work, it's all your fault, guys.
Yeah, this is not on us. It's not our problem.
No. You've been asking for it. Now you're going to get it. Well, Free Comic Book Day will also drop in May.
Yeah, Free Comic Book Day. Not with Dr. Dinosaur, so deal with that.
Because you get a whole volume.
You get a whole volume. I mean, what more do you want?
It does tie into that volume, though.
Yeah, it does.
I think that's it, right?
I think that's all we got going.
Hi, guys. This is Cap from the future, which is now your past, but more future than when we recorded this episode. Some technical stuff happened, and we weren't able to release this episode until, well, now. And as a result, we don't have time to do the rest of Volume 1. No, we got to move on to brand new Robo stuff. So expect us to be picking up Volume 1 and every successive volume periodically in between Robo volumes. We got to move on to bigger things like the new Free Comic Book Day, Volume 8. Maybe even some other stuff, too. Because that Atomic Robo film from the Victory, its release is right around the corner. And celebrating it, they put out a game for the iPod and iPad called Violent Science. It's an Atomic Robo side-scroller. Have you not always wanted that? We'll have a link to where you can pick that up on this episode's page. Also, Brian and Scott put together an exclusive comic for Comixology. It's a digital comic made for the digital comics medium. It's got all those dramatic panel-to-panel frame reveal kind of pseudo-animation things that you've come to know and love from things like Mark Waid's Thrillbent webcomics, etc. So that's over at Comixology. We'll have a link to where you can pick that up on this episode's page. And it's a brand new Robo story. It's called Atomic Robo, Two-Fisted Tales. Along came a Tyrantula. And I did say that weird on purpose. So check those out. Links on this episode's page. And also, I can't say this with 100% certainty, but there's a good chance that at this year's Heroes Con in June, there could be a live version of Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts with Brian, Scott, and I. Just putting that out there, you might want to head over to Heroes Con in Charlotte, North Carolina, to get a front row seat for a live, all-new Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts. As the Mick kids would say, hey, it could happen. And, you better be sure to run out to your comic shop today. Or follow the link on this episode's page where you can pick it up online. Because, oh my god, there's a new Atomic Robo Real Science Adventures out. So be sure to pick up issue 7 of Atomic Robo Real Science Adventures today, wherever you get comic books from. So for Atomic Robo volumes, physical and digital, and any other Atomic Robo stuff you need, you can head to this episode's page, or you can go to atomic-robo.com. Do it now! And once again, if you got any questions for Brian and Scott, you know where to hit us up, Nerdy Show forums or on Twitter, #AskRobo. I'm Cap.
I'm Brian.
I'm the pumpkin.
Later.
Nuts and bolts.
Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts is brought to you by Nerdy Show. If you somehow enjoyed what you've heard, you can show your support by telling a friend or going to nerdyshow.com and clicking the support button. Even a small contribution gets you cool nerdy perks, possibly crystals, and allows you to take part in our monthly support drive contests. For more episodes of Atomic Robo Nuts and Bolts, videos, contests, and other nerdy programming, visit nerdyshow.com. Subscribe to all the Nerdy Show Network's latest episodes via the iTunes Store, and remember to follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at Nerdy Show and Dr. Dinosaur. For all Atomic Robo news, go to atomic-robo.com, a highly inefficient URL.